Dive into our text this evening then. We are in 2 Kings chapter 8. We tried to catch us all up last time looking at the historical timeline of things. So I brought up our timeline once again just to refresh our memories of what's going on here. This upper line is the northern kingdom's kings. This bottom line is the lower kingdom's. So we are, we're 100 and some odd years after the breakup of the kingdom. We've had several kings. We're in the third dynasty of the north. Of course, the same dynasty of the south. Ahab was the most recent, well-known king of the northern kingdom. He is dead now. Jehoshaphat is still king in the southern kingdom. If you'll notice, we'll cover this a little bit when we get there, but, if you look at chapter 8, verse 16, here's a little nice... Yes, go ahead. 2 Kings, chapter 8. I mispronounced the first time. It's 2 Kings, chapter 8. Yep. And look at verse 16. Verse 16 jumps back into the chronological narrative. For several chapters now, we've been in a more topical section dealing with Elisha's ministry, and we'll finish that up here this evening. But verse 16 says, in the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel. So in the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel. I got myself confused there. When Jehoshaphat was king of Judah, there's a marker. Because who's king of the northern kingdom? The northern kingdom is Joram or Jehoram. The southern kingdom, it says, when Jehoshaphat was king. So Jehoshaphat is still king in the south, but what does it say? Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign. That's unusual. That doesn't happen too often in the history of the kings, that Jehoshaphat is king and installs his son as king as well. So what's happening, as you can see on the chart, in the fifth year of Joram, this right here, this is Jehoram, the son of Ahab, and you bring it down to the bottom, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, becomes what is called co-rex with his father. Jehoshaphat is still alive. Normally speaking, the son didn't become king until his father passed away. But there were a couple of instances where the kingdoms overlapped. So if you're ever trying to put together the timeline of the kings of Israel, you have to pay attention to a detail like that, which I'll fully admit I would not have noticed had not this fellow that put these charts together pointed it out. But it's clearly a different wording there than what we normally get, because normally it'll say Jehoshaphat died when he was so-and-so years old and his son Jehoram took the throne. Okay, but right here it says, when Jehoshaphat was king, Jehoram became king. So there is an overlapping of kingdoms there. But that just shows you where we're at. Jehoshaphat is still the king of the southern kingdom. Joram, or Jehoram, is king of the northern 10 tribes. Chapter 8, verse 1. So back up just a little bit in the chapter is actually the text we want to deal with. Chapter 8, verse 1. That's the time period we're in. It says, now Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life. Got to think back here. It's been a couple of months since we dealt with this. But if you remember the Shunammite woman, she prepared a room where Elisha could stay whenever he was passing through town. It was up on the top of her house. And so he wanted to do something to thank her. And his servant Gehazi says, well, her husband is old and she has no son. I think she'd really love to have a son. And so Elisha says, next year, you're going to have a baby boy. She does have a baby boy. And in the course of time, after a few years, the text says when he had grown up, but it doesn't mean like full grown, it just means he's older. It says he went out to his father in the field and said, oh, my head, my head. Probably with something like a sunstroke or heat stroke or something. And he collapses. Daddy carries him back to the house. I think that's one of the ways we know he's still a younger boy. His dad carries him, and we're specifically told that his dad is already an aged man. And so Dad carries him back to the house, and a few hours later, he dies in Mommy's arms. Mama lays him in the prophet's chamber and sends her servant to fetch Elisha. Well, Elisha comes back and raises him back to life. So that's the backstory of what's going on here. That same woman, at some point, Elisha had said. So we're put in a verb tense that tells us that what Elisha says here happened in the past from the perspective of the story. So Elisha had said to the woman whose son he had restored to life, "Arise and depart with your household and sojourn wherever you can, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will come upon the land for 7 years." We're not sure exactly when this famine happens, because starting from chapter, starting from about chapter 4 up until now, we are in a topical section. Everything we've been dealing with has been dealing with Elisha and his miracles and his ministry. It's not necessarily chronological. We're actually going to see some things in the text today that tell us this can't be chronological, right? But we're dealing topically. And so here we have to flash back to something that Elisha told this woman. Get out of the land, there's going to be a famine, and it's going to last for 7 years. Now, the only other famine that we have referenced in the text is back in chapter... Not the famine that happened while Syria was besieging Samaria. But back in chapter 4, verse 38, it says, "Elijah came again to Gilgal when there was a famine in the land, and the sons of the prophets were sitting before him." And this is where they throw the poison gourds into the pot, and Elisha purifies them. That was during a famine. It's possible that those are the same famine. And so that would tell us that that account of purifying the gourds actually happened after he told the woman to get out of Israel. But he warns her that there's going to be a famine. It's going to last for 7 years. And we are probably looking at sometime during the reign of Jehoram up here in the north. And we have 12 years span there during his reign in which this thing could have happened. But the author notes what Elisha said to the woman previously, because it sets us up for what's going to be happening presently. And so he told her, "Get lost." Verse 2, "The woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistines for 7 years." So she left behind her home, and she took her entire household, servants, son, and everything, and went to Philistia. Apparently the famine was fairly local. What might that signify? Punishment. Okay, when God does something very unique like that, and you've got, look, the entire land of Israel is only, 60, 70 miles wide. And you have a famine in the middle 40 miles, but not in the other 30 miles. That's odd. It's just affecting the land of Israel. God is trying to get his people's attention. Because Jehoram, though he's a little more friendly with Elisha, is still not leading the people in repentance and back to covenant faithfulness. He is following in the footsteps of his father Ahab. And things are only going to get worse, as we'll see. But God is trying to get his people's attention, and really it's probably a last opportunity, because you can see the next name up here in the list is a fellow named Jehu. We're going to get to this account in just a little bit, but Jehu is an entirely new dynasty. He's not descended from Jehoram. In fact, God raises up Jehu and says, "You're going to wipe out Ahab's house," and he does. So this famine may be the last opportunity for the northern kingdom to repent before God brings an even more serious judgment upon them. So here's the backstory. This woman has been gone for 7 years. We're not told exactly where she went, because it's not all that important to the narrative. But she's been gone for 7 years. So you have to think about what might happen if you just up and left your house for 7 years. What might you find when you get back? Animals might be there. Your home's been taken over. How often does a house just sit vacant for 7 years and nobody moves in? Well, you know, we kind of keep close eyes on things these days, but that kind of technology didn't exist back then, and there's a good chance you leave your house that long, somebody's going to move in. I mean, after all, we're told she's a woman of some means, she's wealthy, and her husband's aged. The fact that her husband doesn't get mentioned in this narrative, by the way, I think he's probably passed away by this point. We'll see why here in just a minute. But it's been 7 years. So verse 3, at the end of 7 years, when the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, she went to appeal to the king for her house and her land. So why would she have to appeal to the king for it? Somebody's living in it. Homestead Act. How long do you have to live in a place before it becomes yours? Yeah, I don't think it actually exists anymore. Maybe it used to. I should check that. I don't know. Are there any empty houses we can just move into? And oh, okay. I didn't know that. Well, the woman has to go appeal this decision because there's somebody there. Now, I think there's two possibilities here. Either somebody moved in and is squatting on the land. You know, George Washington had to deal with squatters. He was granted a big tract of land out near Pittsburgh because of his service during the French and Indian War. And when he sent surveyors out to check it out, he found a bunch of people living on it, and he had to evict them because they thought it was just all open land. But anyway, she comes back and she finds people living in her house, so she has to go to the king. So option number one is that somebody else has moved in. Option number two is that she hasn't been keeping up on her taxes, and it's actually the king that's repossessed the house and taken it over. We're not sure which. The text doesn't elaborate, but all we know is that she needs an answer from the king, so she's got to go up to this highest authority to get her house back. Here's where things start to get interesting, because verse 4, now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God. Now, what do we know about Gehazi? Anybody remember the name Gehazi? Did he get leprous? He did get leprous. Why did he get leprous? He was selfish. Anybody remember the account? Why did he get turned leprous? Yep. You're on it. It's back in chapter 5. Naaman, the Syrian, comes to visit Elisha because Naaman has leprosy. And he has a servant girl that's an Israelite. And she says, hey, the man of God that's in Israel can cure you. So he comes down. Elisha says, go wash in the Jordan River 7 times. He does it, and he's healed. He offers Elisha a big chunk of money, and Elisha refuses. So after Naaman leaves, Gehazi says, well, I can get in on that action. Chases after Naaman, convinces him to give him money and clothes, and when Elisha discovers it, because the Lord told him, he curses Gehazi and makes him leprous. So, we find Gehazi standing here talking to the king. What does that tell us about the timing of these events? Naaman hasn't happened yet. Right? This is one of the reasons we know these stories are not necessarily chronologically ordered. They are ordered by subject. Because if Gehazi has leprosy, you can bet he's not in the presence of the king. And so this account probably happens shortly before the story of Naaman. And because at that, it specifically tells us too that Elisha sent Gehazi away. He was no longer his servant. So here's Gehazi talking to King Jehoram. And King Jehoram, verse 4, says, tell me all the great things that Elisha has done. And so verse 5, while he was telling the king how Elisha had restored the dead to life, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appealed to the king for her house and for her land. So you can imagine this scene as Gehazi's telling this story, and then Elisha walked in, and he stretched himself out on the boy, and then the boy sneezed 7 times, and Elisha paced back and forth in the room, and then he laid down again, and then the boy came up to life, and king, that's him, right there. That's the guy. He's grown a little bit since then because he's been gone for 7 years, but there he is, and that's his mom. What a strange coincidence. Right? You believe in coincidence? Hope not. Okay. Now, why do you think the Lord might have had Gehazi standing here talking to the king about this woman right at the point she comes in to ask for her land back? Because we all know how politics work, right? It's not about what's right and wrong. It's about who you know. And so now suddenly this woman, who probably has no reason to be paid attention to by the king, has an in. And God's going to grant her favor in the king's sight just because he's just been hearing this story. You know, there's lots of pastors get to go and pray with presidents throughout the years. They've never asked me. I don't know why. You know, I mean, I can pray along with the rest of those guys, can't I? But you know why? I don't know them. I don't know anybody. That's why those things happen that way. I joked with Kim as we were walking up. Or I joked with you guys this morning too. Yeah, me and Ken Ham were like this. I got my picture taken with him. Don't mind the 800 other people that got their picture taken with Ken Ham this week. You know, they're just acquaintances. Me and him, though, we're tight. Well, sometimes it is about who you know. And those connections can help. And so the Lord arranges that Gehazi's telling this woman's story at the exact moment that she walks into the courtroom to present her case. And so Gehazi says, "My lord, O king, here's the woman, and here's her son whom Elisha restored to life." Well, great thing. Verse 6, "And when the king asked the woman, she told him the problem. And so the king appointed an official for her, saying, 'Restore all that was hers, together with all the produce of the fields from the day that she left the land until now.'" Now how's that for God granting you favor and success? Not only does she get her land back, but he orders that every bit of food that was grown on that land in the last 7 years be restored to her. Now how do you feel as the squatter? You know, maybe this wasn't such a great deal after all. Got to watch out for those kinds of things. So that starts to wrap up Elisha's ministry summary. We're still going to encounter him. And especially in this next section. But this next section is going to start moving us back to the chronological narrative. All right, the narrative of the kings. And it's something that began way back in 1 Kings chapter 19. And we'll take a look at that. Verse 7, "Now Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick." Hadad is one of the Syrian gods. It's the storm god. He's kind of the same as Marduk or Baal. Ben-Hadad means the son of Hadad. Ancient kings were very fond of calling themselves the son of the gods. It gave them prestige. It gave them a claim to the throne. Because if they were an adopted son of the god, or in some cases they actually believed they were sons of the god, then they had the authority to sit on the throne of that god's kingdom. And Satan likes to mimic what God does, doesn't he? So, who's going to be the king? Jesus is. Who is Jesus? He is the Son of God. Now, Satan likes to mock that. Well, Elisha goes to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, the king of Syria, was sick. And it was told to him, "The man of God has come here." Now, again, we're not exactly sure what the timing of this is, because it's back in this topical section. But the man of God has come here, so obviously Ben-Hadad wants to search him out and find out if I'm going to recover from this sickness. And it's not because Ben-Hadad was faithful to Jehovah, it's because Ben-Hadad is searching out probably every god he can find. He's trying to entreat the favor of, just in case that's the god that has him pinpointed for death. And so I don't think that there's anything here that's saying that Ben-Hadad is having a turn of heart or an awakening of faith or anything. He's just searching out all of the different priests of different religions to help him. And so he says to Hazael, his servant, "Take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?'" Now, does anybody remember the name Hazael? I'm going to stretch your memories. This goes way, way back. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 19. 1 Kings chapter 19. In 1 Kings 19, Elijah has fled from Jezebel. This is after the contest at Mount Carmel. And he has gone all the way down to Mount Sinai, where the Lord appears to him. And the Lord sustains him there for quite some time. But then he gives him a couple of tasks. And in verse 15, the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel. And Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place." How many of those things did Elijah actually get done in the course of his life? There were three things there. You're going to anoint Hazael, king of Damascus. You're going to anoint Jehu, the king of Israel. And you're going to anoint Elisha to take your place as prophet. How many did he actually do? Just one. The only one he did was anoint. Oh, he didn't even anoint Jehu yet. Yeah, he anointed Elisha, right? So he leaves undone these other ones. And now Elisha is going to carry that on and continue the work. And so here is Elisha. He's finally gone up to Damascus, and he gets this summons to come meet somebody's inquiring of him. The king of Syria is inquiring of him. So Hazael comes in verse 9. So Hazael went to meet him, and he took a present with him, all kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. That's a lot of stuff. Now, one of the commentaries I was reading said that oftentimes in the ancient world, when they sent a present like this and they list it by camels, it's not because every camel was fully loaded. It's because they wanted it to make it look really, really big. And so they would put like one or two things on each camel so that you see all these camels coming, and then, you know, they would present the things one at a time and make it seem really, really big. So it's not necessarily, I think a camel can carry something like 200 or 300 pounds worth of pack. It's crazy. So we're probably not looking at as the maximum amount that a camel could carry, but we are looking at a very large gift that the king of Syria has sent to Elisha. And so when he came and stood before him, he said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?'" And so they're asking the servant of God, "What has God decreed for me? Am I going to get better? Or am I going to die?" Verse 10, this answer is going to be interesting. "Elisha said to him, 'Go, say to him, you shall certainly recover. But the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die.'" So let me ask you, is Elisha telling this man to lie to the king? This is just water, by the way. It's not coffee. Tim. Okay, so you think he's saying he's going to recover from the disease but then die. Okay? What do you think? Is Elisha telling Hazael to lie to Ben-Hadad? "Go tell your king, you shall certainly recover, but I know that he certainly will die." What do you think, Kathy? He's not telling him to lie. Okay. He's just playing on the words. Okay. So he's not going to recover. Okay. So you're saying the distinction is the disease isn't going to kill him, but he's going to die. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, Gary? What's Henry Morris say?
He said that he recovered from that, but somebody could
Mm-hmm. Yep. That is what happens. He, in fact, does not recover from the sickness, but it is not the sickness that kills him. Okay? He would have recovered had events not gone the way that they go. Here's an interesting question. Does God know all things? Does he know all that is going to happen? Does he know all that could have happened? Think of any scriptural proofs that show us that God knows all things that are potential as well as all things that are actual. There are some people that deny this, by the way, that God only knows what's possible. He doesn't know what actually will happen. And some people say God can't even know what is probable. He can only know what's possible. But I think of this passage when Jesus is talking to the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and he says, if the signs that had been done in you had been done in Sodom and Gomorrah, they would have repented in sackcloth and ashes. What is that? That's an alternate reality that he's letting us in on. If something had happened, then this would have happened. So you can imagine that every event in history is another point on this little tree, and it expands infinitely in every direction as we think about, well, how would that affect everything that goes beyond it? So, you know, how would life be different if you had not met your spouse? What would life be like? And think about all the things that it affects. Now, what'd you have for breakfast this morning? That might not affect as many things, but it still affects them, doesn't it? And God knows all of those potentialities. Well, I think he is going in here a little bit of a play on words, and he's saying, you know, the sickness is not what's going to take Ben-Hadad's life. He'll recover. Unless something else happens, but I know that thing is going to happen. And verse 11, because Elisha knows what's going to happen, it says he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was embarrassed. That's not Elijah being embarrassed. Sorry, Elisha being embarrassed. That's Hazael being embarrassed because Elisha is staring at him so intently. We asked this question this morning. Anybody ever locked their gaze on you and just not let up on it? Sometimes it's hard to endure, and you might be wondering, is this person nuts or what's going on? Because it's unusual. People don't usually lock their gaze on us this long. And we try to meet their gaze for a little while, and then you try to think of something to say to break the conversation. Because usually if somebody is going to start talking, what do? They look away for a second to think about what they're going to say, and then you say, ooh, good. But Elisha just keeps staring at him. Because he knows what's going to happen here. And finally, Hazael is embarrassed, and then Elisha starts crying. Now, I have had people cry when they look at me, which is obvious. You know, Kim's never done it, but he starts weeping, and Hazael says, why does my Lord weep? What's going on? And Elisha answered, because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You'll set on fire their fortresses, and you will kill their young men with the sword and dash in pieces their little ones and rip open their pregnant women. Would that scene flickering in your head make you weep? I'm sure it would. And Elisha's looking at this man, and by the word of the Lord, he knows this is the guy that's going to cause all these atrocities. Well, verse 13, here's Hazael's response. He hears this and he says, what is your servant who is but a dog that he should do this great thing? Now, what do you think about that response? What's Hazael trying to say? I would never. But does he say, I would never? He kind of says, how could I do that? I'm nobody. There's a little difference, isn't there? And I notice also the thing that he calls it. What does he call it?
A great thing.
Now, that word great does not necessarily imply goodness. It implies magnitude. It's big. Who am I? I couldn't do this big thing. But I kind of note that he doesn't call it an atrocity. He doesn't call it an abomination. He doesn't react against the violence of it or the horror of it. He simply says, I'm nobody. I couldn't do that. Because what is Israel's relationship to Syria at this point? Very tense. In fact, they are at, not constant war, but they are frequently at war with each other, except for some little odd times of peace. So Syria and Israel, not on good relationship, and Hazael here is probably thinking, whoa, who am I? I could do that. I'm just a servant to the king. So verse 14, then he departed from Elisha and came to his master, and who said to him, what did Elisha say to you? And he answered, he told me that you would certainly recover, which is what Elisha told him. He'll recover. But which part of the message does he leave off? Yeah, you're going to die. You would recover, but you're going to die. So verse 15, these events have solidified in Hazael's mind the course of action that he wants to take. You can probably be certain that he has already been thinking about doing this, and this encounter with Elisha just solidified it. Now he's ready. Because look what he does. Verse 15, the next day he took the bedcloth, dipped it in water, and spread it over his face, suffocates him until he died. And then Hazael becomes king in his place. No, this is Hazael takes the rag, dips it in water, and puts it over the king's face and murders the king. Okay? Yep. Yeah, this isn't the king killing himself. This is Hazael killing the king. And so Hazael becomes king in his place. Now, we notice there that Elisha didn't exactly anoint him to be king, but he did set these things in motion and give Hazael this opportunity to say, I know what you're going to do. But this brings us to the point where the narrative is going to start coming around again to the chronological history of the nation of Israel. We're going to get back in verse 16 to a little bit about the southern kingdom. Are there any questions about what's been going on up till here? Kathy looks like she's got a question. Mm-hmm.
So to me that sounded like...
Right, yeah. Sometimes tracking the pronouns and the antecedents is a little tricky. And the Hebrew writing is kind of like English, too. We don't always follow the proper rules of it because the antecedent is supposed to be the nearest referent, right? The last person mentioned by name is usually the he, but not always. And so the last person that was referenced is Hazael. Back in beginning of 13, Hazael said, who is your servant? I'm but a dog, that he should do this great thing. Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you are to be king over Israel. Then he, that's Hazael, right, departed from Elisha and came to his master, that would be the king, who said to him, what did Elisha say to you? So we get into these pronouns that are a little tricky to track there. But it is in fact Hazael murdering the king, Ben-Hadad. This was not uncommon in the ancient world, by the way. A peaceful succession of kings was rather the exception than the rule. Many of them, and in a lot of the nations that were there, many of them were, the next king was a coup. He rose up, assassinated the former guy, and then takes control. And that's what Hazael is doing here. Any other questions or comments? Good question, by the way. Track those pronouns. Sometimes it's hard. Hopefully, as you see, as these events go on, that these are not random, disconnected, disjointed events, but this is God is at work in these series of things. Because while we dive into details sometimes, I don't want us to lose sight of the big picture, that what's going on in the book of Kings is the rise and fall of the nation of Israel, the kingdom of Israel. It goes through a period of faithfulness under David in the beginning of Solomon, and so you hit the height of prosperity and security. But from there on, once Solomon turns, Once he begins worshiping the idols, it's this downhill trek. We're going to have a few little bumps as some of the kings bring revival, but it is generally a downhill trend towards greater idolatry, greater faithlessness to the covenant, and eventually being kicked out of the land. That's why the writer of Kings wrote this down, so that we could see why it is Israel got kicked out. Why did God kick his people out of the land? Because of this kind of stuff. And they are not untouched by the nations around them. They were supposed to be a nation of priests, but very often we find them acting just like Syria. And there is a little bit of a warning in that as well for New Testament believers. We're not nations, we're individuals. Church is not made up of nations, it's made up of people. But we have some of the same warnings. Come out from among them and be separate, says the Lord, and you shall be my people. What's he talking about? Don't act like the world around you. Be faithful to the covenant we live under, the new covenant. James calls it the law of liberty. Be faithful to that and don't succumb to starting to look like and act like and think like the people out there. Doesn't mean you don't interact with them, because we have to. We should. But it means don't start thinking like they do. Creation Museum, great example of that. The church has bought into this idea that either God used millions of years or the Bible, the first few chapters, are unreliable. What does that eventually do? It unravels your entire theology. Because if I think that this portion of the Bible is not clear, doesn't clearly communicate what happened, then what other portions of the Bible don't clearly communicate what happened? Because there is no reason to take the language in Genesis 1 through 12 any differently than you take the rest of the Bible. You know, we agree that there are poetic portions. Job, very poetic. The Psalms, poetic. Song of Solomon, very poetic. Genesis 1 through 12, it's historical narrative. It reads just like this stuff does. Except that it's things that we've never seen before. How many of us have seen God say, "Let there be light," and there was light? Nobody's ever seen it. But if God spoke it, and there's no reason to take it as figurative, then we take it as true. And so those are just some of the things that happen when God's people start to adopt the ways of thinking of the world around them rather than thinking about life from the word that God has given us. All right, one last chance. Any other questions or comments? Great. All right, let's pray. Well, Father, we know that all of us